scheduled for August 14th. For more on this, we continue with James Risen, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, now with The Intercept, where he's senior national security correspondent, also director of First Look's media's Press Freedom Defense Fund. He was a target of the U.S. government's crackdown on journalists and whistleblowers himself and won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting at the New York Times about warrantless wiretapping of Americans by the National Security Agency. Jim waged a 7-year battle, risking jail, after the Bush administration, then the Obama administration, sought to force him to testify and reveal his confidential sources in a leak investigation. He never gave in. The government finally backed down. Well, now he's written a piece for The Intercept headlined, "Don't Compare Donald Trump to Reality Winner. He's no whistleblower. He's just a thief." Can you elaborate on this, Jim?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the things that bothered me right after the Trump indictment was that there were a lot of pundits starting to compare Trump to people who've been caught up in other espionage cases, including Reality Winner, who was a whistleblower about Russian efforts to hack into American election systems in the 2016 presidential race. And I just thought it was a ridiculous comparison because Trump was just doing this for selfish reasons. He clearly came to believe that keeping classified information was like keeping gold coins. It was a way of keeping something of value and just stealing stealing something of value from the government on his way out the door. I don't think he cared much about public service or about the public interest in this information. He wanted to either sell it to the highest bidder or to continue to use it to gain status somehow. And so I think it's just a horrible comparison to talk in the same breath with people who have risked their lives in order to make the public aware of government abuses like, so many whistleblowers have.
But, Jim, while I agree with you that there's a major difference between whistleblowers and what Trump did, aren't some skeptics of what's happening with this prosecution at least partially right? That, one, there's a major problem of overclassification of documents by the government in this country, and also that this whole issue of the Espionage Act and the dissemination of classified information has been weaponized by the government to go after people.
Yeah, sure. Well, they did it. You know, they've done it in a million cases, including a case I was involved in. So I am no fan of the Espionage Act. I don't think that it should be on the books. I think it should be repealed. But I just find that the irony is very thick here in this case, where he was spending most all of his presidency prosecuting as many whistleblowers as possible and was trying to jail his opponents, have anybody who leaked investigated, and now he's caught up in it. So I'm not advocating this is the right way to conduct government operations by having an espionage act. I just find it very ironic. And to me, it's kind of like Al Capone, who got, on his murderous reign in Chicago, ultimately got caught up in a tax evasion case. To me, that's, Trump is a criminal. He's a pathological liar. And the irony is this is the kind of the Al Capone tax evasion case, in my opinion. It's something that the government could get them on because they didn't get them on other things.
And finally, just 10 seconds, Walt Nauta is going to be arraigned today, Jim Risen. You have another piece talking about how lackeys always take the fall for President Trump.
Yeah, I mean, he is a classic Trump lackey. He's a low-level guy who probably had no idea what was going on. He just followed orders, and then Trump used him and abused him and set him up in a situation where everything he was doing was illegal. And I'm sure Trump tried to convince this poor guy from the Navy that, you know, he was the president and he could set the laws. I'm sure it's somebody who had no idea what he was really doing and then finally got caught up because he agreed to lie and obstruct justice for Trump. And so I think if he's smart, he'll flip on Trump. But the track record shows that very few of Trump's lackeys ever do flip on him.
And a number go to jail. James Risen, we're going to continue with you after break. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, formerly with The New York Times, now with The Intercept. But next up, we're going to talk about your major new book, The Last Honest Man, The CIA, the FBI, the Mafia, and the Kennedys, and One Senator's Fight to Save Democracy. We'll be talking about the FBI, the CIA. We'll be talking about assassination plots by the U.S. government against people like Castro, Lumumba, and others. Stay with us.
The only heaven I'll be sent to is when I'm alone with you. I was born sick, but I love it. Command me to be well. Amen. Amen.
Church by Hozier. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We spend the rest of the hour with James Risen, the twice Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, formerly with The New York Times, now with The Intercept. He's just published a major new book that looks at a watershed moment in American intelligence history, when Idaho Senator Frank Church led the Church Committee investigating for the first time the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA during hearings from 1975 to 76. It was officially called the Select Committee to Study Governmental Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities. This is Senator Frank Church speaking during one of the committee hearings.
We have seen today the dark side of those activities, where many Americans who were not even suspected of crime were not only spied upon, but they were harassed, they were discredited, and at times endangered.
And this is another clip from the Church Committee Senate hearings, CIA Director William Colby testifying. He was asked if he found the work of the committee unwelcome.
No, I do not. As I've said to the chairman, I welcome the chance to try to describe to the American people what intelligence is really about today. It is an opportunity to show how we Americans have modernized the whole concept of intelligence.
So that's CIA Director William Colby testifying by the Church Committee, which investigated U.S. assassination targets from Castro in Cuba to Lumumba in Congo to Diem in Vietnam. This is the focus of the new book by James Risen, titled The Last Honest Man, The CIA, the FBI, the Mafia, and the Kennedys in One Senator's Fight to Save Democracy. Jim, this is a fascinating read. It is so important, even what, some 50 years later. If you can talk about why you focused on Senator Church, who at one time hoped to be president of the United States, but the significance of these hearings and what you were most shocked by in the revelations that he discovered around U.S. government activity around the world.
Sure. Yeah, the reason I wanted to write this book was, you know, I was covering the CIA for the New York Times at the time of 9/11. And I was, if you remember, Dick Cheney started, after 9/11, started complaining constantly that the reason the CIA and the FBI had failed to uncover the terrorist plots was because of the Church Committee, which was a very odd thing to say, because the Church Committee had taken place 25 years earlier, and Frank Church was long dead by that time. But it became the mantra of the Bush administration that it was the Church Committee's tighter rules on U.S. intelligence operations that had led to the weakness of intelligence, which was a lie. But it was a very powerful lie that continued for years. And so after I started reading about the Church Committee because of Dick Cheney's constant carping about it, and I decided eventually that it was something that I really wanted to write a book about. The Church Committee, I think, is probably the most important congressional investigation in modern American history. It was a watershed moment in the history of the CIA and the FBI and the NSA. Anybody who worked at those the intelligence community knows that there is a before and after. There's a before the Church Committee and what we could get away with, and there's an after the Church Committee and what rules we were now imposed on them to limit their power and their flexibility. And I think you've got to get back into the mindset of the time and remember there was no congressional oversight whatsoever of the CIA, the FBI, or the NSA for three decades. And Frank Church was brought in. This committee was created in 1975 to conduct the very first oversight and very first investigation ever conducted of the CIA. And at the time, you got to remember the FBI was just as much of a rogue organization. J. Edgar Hoover had just died, and he had run the organization since its founding. And no one had ever questioned his authority or his power. And the NSA at the time, very few Americans even knew it existed. It was even more secretive, far more secretive even than it is today. And so the hearings were explosive, and they led to changes in the laws, changes in executive orders, led to the creation of permanent congressional intelligence oversight, and it had a dramatic impact on American national security policy.
And Jim, you mentioned J. Edgar Hoover. He had died in 1972, a few years before the committee. Would this committee have even been possible had J. Edgar Hoover not died? Because you point out how critical he was to the incipient development of a police state right here in the United States. I wonder if you could talk about that as well, his role in developing this early move toward a police state.
Yeah. I mean, when the Church Committee was created, it was originally just going to be what they called the CIA Committee, and they were just going to investigate the CIA. But Frank Church and others on the committee very quickly realized they had to investigate the FBI. And Church and others later admitted they never would have been able to investigate the FBI at the time if J. Edgar Hoover was still alive. He was so powerful. He had been able to pressure and blackmail and intimidate everyone, both in Congress and in the White House, ever since, before World War II. He was probably the most powerful secret figure in modern American history, and he was able to turn the FBI into like a Gestapo organization, especially in the post-World War II era, when he began the whole communist red-baiting witch hunts, and then moved on from that in the 1960s to harass the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. And so he had this long history of constant harassment of anyone who opposed him or opposed the status quo in the United States. And he did it in a way that he had intimidated everyone in Congress who believed that he had blackmail material on them. Whether he did or not, they all believed it. And so no one was willing to take him on or even investigate the FBI in any meaningful way until he was dead. One of the really interesting things that I learned was the famous burglary of the FBI office in Medea, Pennsylvania, I think in 1971, where the burglars, who were basically anti-war dissidents, took a bunch of documents and then began to understand what they were looking at only after they had taken the documents. And they started parceling them out to members of Congress and journalists who they thought would be helpful in disclosing and airing the information that they were providing to them. And they were sending it to them anonymously. And they were sending to very liberal members of Congress. And one of the things that I learned that was shocking was that those members of Congress immediately turned them back to the FBI without doing anything with them. And some of the journalists they sent them to did the same thing. And it just showed how powerful the hold J. Edgar Hoover had on people, because he was still alive at that time.
And your review and reporting on several of the major assassination attempts that government agencies, especially the CIA, were involved in. You spent a lot of time talking back about the key mafia figures, Johnny Roselli, a mobster from California, and Sam Giancana, another mobster, a key mobster from Chicago. They were both assassinated. One after testifying before the Church Commission, and the other one just before he was about to testify before the Church Committee. Could you, especially for younger listeners and viewers who are not aware of this whole issue of what happened with attempt to kill Castro and the Kennedy assassination? Could you go through some of that?
Yeah. At the end of the Eisenhower administration, the CIA decided, you know, Dwight Eisenhower was very interested. It was pushing the CIA to try to kill Castro. The CIA decided that one way they could do it is to form a secret alliance with the mafia. And so they arranged for a former FBI agent named Bob Mayhew, who was also on contract with the CIA, to contact mobsters around the country to see if they would form an alliance to work with the CIA to get into to Cuba and kill Castro. And so he first contacted Johnny Roselli, who was a flamboyant mobster operating both in Los Angeles and Las Vegas. And Roselli then contacted Sam Giancana, who was the boss of the Chicago mob. And the two of them then contacted Santo Traficante, who was the mob boss of Florida and who had longtime casino operations in Cuba before Castro took over. And so they went with Mayhew to Miami Beach and set up a shop in the Fontainebleau Hotel to try to figure out how to get poisons to somebody close to Castro who could kill him. But the plot kind of unraveled very quickly because Giancana had a girlfriend in Las Vegas, Phyllis McGuire, one of the famous McGuire sisters of a singing act. And he was convinced that she was sleeping with a stand-up comedian named Dan Rowan, who later became famous in the Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In show in the late 60s. And so he wanted to leave and go back to Las Vegas and maybe kill Dan Rowan. But Bob Mayhew convinced him to stay and keep working on Castro while he got a private investigator to go wiretap Phyllis McGuire to see if it was true. And the private investigator he hired to wiretap Phyllis McGuire did a shoddy job, and the local police found the wiretap and called the FBI. And suddenly J. Edgar Hoover was pulling a thread and finding out all about, through the arrest in Las Vegas and the investigation of the wiretap of Phyllis McGuire, they found out about the CIA's mafia alliance. And then that led them to find that Sam Giancana had another mistress named Judith Campbell, who at the same time was also sleeping with President Kennedy. And so very quickly, J. Edgar Hoover had blackmail material on President Kennedy, and he confronted Robert Kennedy, his brother, who was the attorney general at the time. And then he also confronted President Kennedy. And it's very clear, if you look at the timing, and the is that what he wanted was greater freedom to act to spy on Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. And it wasn't long after he confronted the Kennedys with this blackmail material about the fact that Kennedy was sharing the same mistress as Sam Giancana, that the Kennedys approved the wiretapping of Martin Luther King by the FBI. And so it was a very convoluted story, but it's probably one of the most fascinating stories in the history of the CIA and the FBI.
And Jim Risen, if you can continue on that, the wiretapping of Dr. King, a man who, and especially in Jonathan Eig's new biography, King, A Life, talks about how Dr. Martin Luther King suffered from severe depression, was hospitalized a number of times, and how they tried to drive him to suicide, and what the Kennedys right. knew and when they knew it, Jim.
Right. One of the things that became clear is that Hoover had been obsessed with King beginning in the late 1950s. As soon as King began to rise to prominence after the Montgomery bus boycott, he was in the sights of Hoover. And Hoover began to be very quickly became convinced that the King and his civil rights movement were controlled by Moscow, and that they were communist puppets. And there were two members of King's organization that had some background in the American Communist Party. But there was no evidence of any real influence, communist influence, in the civil rights movement. And the FBI staff, intelligence division staff, continually told Hoover that. And he kept telling them that he didn't agree with them and he wanted them to change their opinion and change their reports. And he put so much pressure on them that they finally just began to harass, come up with plots to harass King however they could. Originally, the wiretapping that the Kennedys approved was supposed to be to find communist infiltration in King's movement. But very quickly, they realized there was no evidence of that, but they were finding evidence that he was having affairs, extramarital affairs. And so they began to focus on his extramarital affairs and then ultimately, once he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, that so enraged Hoover that he and his intelligence chief, William Sullivan, began to set up a thing where they took all the recordings, highlights of the recordings of the wiretaps of his extramarital affairs, and sent them to his house, along with a note saying, you have 34 days, you know what you should do, meaning essentially that he was about to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, and they wanted him to kill himself before that.
Can you you talk about in this book the revelations, what you learned in talking to, it's hard to say, the late Dan Ellsberg, but Daniel Ellsberg, who's just died, the right. information of what he gave to Frank Church and how this relates to the assassination of the leader, Diem.
Yeah, I mean, he had a lot of information about Vietnam, but he also, just to step back one step, he had he told me while I was interviewing him the whole backstory to how he ended up leaking the Pentagon Papers and how it and he first went to J. William Fulbright, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, to try to leak the to get the Senate to conduct hearings. And Fulbright refused to do it, and he put the Pentagon Papers, I think in 1969, he put them in a safe at the Foreign Relations Committee and didn't do anything with them. And that was one of the reasons, ultimately, that Ellsberg went to the New York Times, was because he had kept going to the Senate and being turned down. That ultimately led Fulbright, who was so embarrassed by what happened, it led him to leak information to later to Jack Anderson about the CIA and ITT's work in Chile to overthrow Salvador Allende. And that then led to the creation of a subcommittee to investigate all Chile that was chaired by Frank Church, which was a subcommittee that kind of led to the creation of the Church Committee and his larger investigation of the CIA. So it was a very, it was kind of an indirect investigation in tie, but, and then he later also provided information to Church about the Diem assassination and to the fact that there was evidence that Kennedy knew about, he understood in detail what was going to happen in the coup plots against Diem that the CIA was involved with. And the question really boils down to whether or not Kennedy clearly knew there was going to be violence, and the question was whether he actually knew that the assassination was going to be conducted or not. But it was interesting. He really wanted to provide new documents to the Church Committee, and so he met privately with Church.
Jim, I wanted to ask you briefly about another pivotal assassination, the killing of Patrice Lumumba and the involvement of the CIA in that. You write about that in your book as well.
Yeah, the Lumumba was one of the assassinations of foreign leaders, along with Castro and others, that the Church Committee investigated and really exposed for the first time. The CIA... If you remember, Congo was in the midst of extreme violence because it was a Belgian colony, and Belgium had been pressured to grant its independence. And Patrice Lumumba was the first independent leader of the independent country. But Belgium very quickly wanted to regain control. They realized they kind of had buyer's remorse about granting Congo its independence.
Jim, I want to warn you, you just have a minute.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, so Patrice Lumumba was overthrown with the backing of Belgium and the CIA, and then he was assassinated. And the question really was the role of the CIA in that assassination, I believe, was much stronger than what the CIA has said over the decades. There's clearly the CIA helped track Lumumba as he tried to escape, and also had sent hitmen to Congo to try to kill him. So it was very clear that the CIA played a pivotal role in all that.
James Risen, we're going to do part two of this discussion, and we're going to talk more about what ultimately the Church Committee was able to publicly expose with these assassinations. James Risen, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter at The Intercept, his new book is called The Last Honest Man, The CIA, The FBI, The Mafia, and The Kennedys, and When Senators Fight to Save Democracy. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia. Simon Fraser University Campus Radio. Streaming on the internet at www.cjsf.ca.